much. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing well. Everything all settled?
Yeah.
Okay.
Your patience.
Okay, hold on. Let me turn the speaker on.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. So I wanted to remind you what the project is that I'm doing. Again, my name is Binti Kuyate. I'm with the Urban Arts Leadership, a program of Greater Baltimore Cultural Alliance, and under the direction of Kabibi Ajanku, who is the head of equity and inclusion at Greater Baltimore Cultural Alliance. We're doing a project called Beauty Beneath the Blight, which takes a look at Baltimore, especially West Baltimore and Pennsylvania Avenue, from about the 1930s until around 1968, to kind of catalog some of the things that were great about Baltimore before heavy blight hit that particular area.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my missions is to use food and that type of communion as a way to capture some of the change that has happened in Baltimore. So understanding the culture around some of those things, people who've provided food, how people came together, and then just other life stories that somehow food ends up fitting its way into there. So when I saw you at the A Rappers film, I wanted to speak with you because of your connection to Mr. Kellum, and I'm hoping that you're still down to interview. This would be a recorded interview, and because this project is sponsored by the National Endowment for the Arts and partnered with Library of Congress and Smithsonian Folklife Center, we would be archiving the interviews and using them in or using the interviews themselves or the information that we learn in preparing a final exhibit in June.
Okay, well, let me, I'm not sure how well I can help you. Mm-hmm. I'll go ahead and give you a little biographical sketch mm-hmm. to see if I could be able to fit in here. I'm 63, mm-hmm. born in 56. I lived in Reservoir Hill. You know Reservoir Hill?
I don't know every part of Baltimore, but I've heard of Reservoir Hill.
Oh, you're from D.C., right?
I'm from D.C.
Okay, well, you know, Reservoir Hill is not too far from Pennsylvania Avenue.
Okay.
And, you know, my recollections of Pennsylvania Avenue would probably be in the mid-60s when I was a young boy.
Mm-hmm.
Probably when I was about 8-9 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And my connections, you know, for Pennsylvania Avenue mm-hmm. were the movie theaters mm-hmm. that were there, as well as my church was on Pennsylvania Avenue. I went to St. Peter's Clavers. It was a Catholic church. It was where I was baptized, you know, Holy Communion, Confirmation, and all of those other rituals mm-hmm. in Catholicism. But now, that's just the background. You can ask me any questions you want from there.
Oh, well, let's start with your introduction. How would you like to introduce yourself?
How I would like to introduce myself?
Yes, I don't know if you have any other names or just J Boss.
Oh, no, J is J-A-E. It's spelled J-A-E.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I go by J.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I don't have any nicknames or anything.
Okay. And, would you like to let us know anything about the family that you come from? Are you first generation Baltimore, second generation Baltimore?
I probably am, let me see, I am second generation because my family came from the eastern shore of Virginia and Maryland on the other side of the Chesapeake Bay.
Mm-hmm.
And they migrated, my grandmother migrated to Baltimore when my mother was like 8 or 9 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And that migration included my grandmother, my mother, and my two uncles. And they lived, you know, down there somewhere along the avenue. And, you know, they were aspirers. You know, from that area, they moved up to Reservoir Hill, which is on the other side of North Avenue. And I don't know if you can visualize all of this, since you're not in Baltimore, but, you know, North Avenue, back during those times, was kind of a dividing line. You know, from, I guess you could say, white and black. You know, because Pennsylvania Avenue is on the west side. But, yeah, so I guess you could say I'm second generation.
Did that migration, as you think of it, have any effect on how you are as a Baltimorean, how you have moved throughout your life, knowing that your family has migrated to come to this area? Have you left the Baltimore area, or are you still pretty much local?
Certainly. Definitely has an impact, because, you know, when people migrate, I would consider them aspirers, because they're trying to move from one situation into a better situation. So with that there's a mindset of people that are, you know, looking for better, to improve themselves and their lot in life. And with that, my mother, because, you know, we used to live not too far from Pennsylvania Avenue, but in 1964, when the Civil Rights Act came about, fair housing and all that other stuff during the Johnson administration, my mother moved out into, well, I guess you could call the suburbs. And, you know, we moved out when I was in the third grade. So, you know, just to make the connections of the aspiring, you know, even when we moved out in the suburbs, and my mother was a single mother with three kids, but we would always move, you know, in and into houses that were always better, you know, and into, you know, respectable neighborhoods, which definitely rubbed on me because of just the association with that type of thinking, rather than being down there on the avenue, you know, traumatically changed my life. Because I've always wondered what I would be like if we had never moved when I was eight. You know, and now, you know, I've, you know, gone to college, I've got a master's degree, I was an officer in the United States Army, and, you know, most of my family, you know, because I'm the first person in my family that went to college. And from that, all of my nephews and nieces, you know, they've gone to college and stuff. And, you know, continue to aspire. Did I answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Would you like to introduce your mom?
Who my mother is?
Yes.
Yes, my mother, her name was Ardelcie. A-R-D-E-L-C-I-E. Her maiden name was Kellum. And her, I guess, married name would be Porter. But, you know, I came from where my mother, you know, as I said, was a single mother. She raised three kids. I mean, she didn't get married until I was probably about 13. But I have two older sisters. I'm the baby.
Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, okay. Okay, so you're the youngest of your mom's three.
Yes.
Okay, and then you are and she and your mom Ardelcy is Mr. George Blue's sister.
Yes.
Okay, is she younger or older than he?
She was younger.
Okay, and I know I was speaking with Mrs. Edwards, and she was telling me that between you and she and your cousin Alan, that you all have about 10 years blocks between each of you.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's
Okay.
true. Yeah, that is true.
And then, would you like to let us know where you did some of your matriculation as a youngster in Baltimore, and then after when you went into your college years?
Well, I went to elementary school initially. John Eagle Howard, 61, and that's down not too far from Pennsylvania Avenue. And then when my mother moved when I was 8, I went to Grove Park Elementary School, then to Lamell, and then Walbrook Senior High School is where I graduated from. And let me continue.
Sure.
Okay, and then after I graduated from high school, I initially went to Morgan for my freshman year, and then I transferred to Towson and graduated from Towson. And after that, I was in ROTC program, and then I, went into the military as a lieutenant and stayed in the military for about 13 years. And from there, I taught school for about 13 years.
Any particular subject?
Yes, let me see. My degree was in psychology. Then I got a master's degree in English, and that's teaching English as a second language. Well, okay, go ahead.
No, I'm listening.
Oh yeah, because that's right. We're talking too much about me. Let's
No,
go back to her.
no. This is exactly what I would love to hear.
Oh, okay, sure. But yeah, Pennsylvania Avenue had definitely had an impact on me, being young, because just walking up there, as a youngster, and it was in the beginning of its decline. But nevertheless, in my mind as a youngster, that was where all the happenings were at. And every time, let's see, well, my sister would take me to, the movies on Pennsylvania Avenue, because back at that time, there were so many theaters just in that small area. There must have been at least seven. Movies around the Pennsylvania North Avenue area. About seven movie theaters, as well as, because there was always a lot of activity. But I was too young to like participate in, the going ons. I was just like, a young observer, in awe of just, so much that was going on. And, I remember, just walking up there, because it was, walking distance from where my home was at. And, going to church every Sunday, because my sister, who's 10 years older than me, she converted to Catholicism when she was in high school. And I guess that's that uppity shit. All of a sudden, all I know was that we were Catholics. We'd just go up to church every Sunday. And You know, I was going to the baptismal and then the first Holy Communion and all those things. But interestingly enough, my first aspiration when I was young, I wanted to be a priest.
Wow.
You know, and the logic behind that, my rationale at that young age was that this God was supposed to be this, you know, thing that everybody was talking about and you were supposed to be like. Mm-hmm. So I thought the priest was the best thing that you could possibly be. So I wanted to be a priest so I could be next to God. Mm-hmm. As well, he was an important person, mm-hmm. the priest. But, you know, I kind of turned away from that stuff probably in about 2 years. I was only 8, but I left that stuff alone because none of it made sense to me. Mm-hmm. I couldn't understand, you know, why priests didn't get married. Mm-hmm. I thought we were supposed to procreate. Mm-hmm. I didn't understand why I had to give money to God. Mm-hmm. You know, none of that stuff made sense. Then they talk about, you know, not having no idols to worship or God something. Mm-hmm. And I saw that we was worshiping idols, you know. Mm-hmm. So it was so contradictory. And then I had to go to confession. Mm-hmm. And I was so embarrassed to tell the priest the stuff that was going on in my mind. Mm-hmm. I couldn't dare, you know, that you would get, you know, some prayers you had to say. And I couldn't remember any of the prayers, mm-hmm. you know, after I went to confession. So I was living in Catholicism. You know, there's a lot of guilt involved with that. Mm-hmm. So I felt guilty because I couldn't say the prayers. Therefore, I wasn't absolved of any of my sins. Therefore, am I talking too much?
No, you're quite all right.
Okay. Therefore, you know, when I would go to church every Sunday as a young boy, I couldn't go up and get Holy Communion because I felt like I was a sinner. Mm-hmm. And then everybody in the church would look at you and, you know, you'd be sitting back there. Everybody knew you sinned. So you can imagine as an 8-9 year old boy, the pressures that stuff had on me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I kind of rebelled from, you know, church and Christianity in itself, mm-hmm. you know, from that point on, because it didn't make any sense to me.
Yeah. Did that lead you?
So that was at an early age, let me tell you. We're talking about 8 years old.
Yeah, that's a lot of realization.
Yeah. But, and, you know, so far as my uncle, you know, Uncle Blue, he was my grandmother's, one of my grandmother's sons, because I had two uncles. And he was, quote unquote, the one that was not the aspirer mm-hmm. in the family. You know, he was the, you know, the man in the family who, you know, didn't have an education, you know, all those things that were supposed to be bad, you know. And at one time I had, you know, disdain because, you know, I come from a family full of women. My Uncle Blue was the only other male above me. Mm-hmm. You know, he's like 20, 30 years older than me. I'm not sure. But he was like, you know, the male image above me. Mm-hmm. And, but, you know, because he basically hustled. That's how he got his money. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whereas my other uncle, you know, he had went into the Army and he worked at General Motors and all that other stuff.
Mm-hmm. Did the way that they made their movements, or just the time motivate you to make your decisions about your life any differently, be it that by 10 you were making different religious choices, or be it that you decided to go into the Army yourself? Did any of that, did you ever see a link between that? And if not, why did you decide that How did you feel being a 10-year-old coming to these different realizations? How did you feel being a teenager going into the Army?
Well, you know, I've always been an observer of life and of people, as well as a participant in life. And, you know, my observations that, you know, I always wanted to be something. Can you hold on for 1 second? Yeah. You want to say okay. You know, and I think I got this from my mother. I'm sure, no, I did. You know, just being an inspirer. You know, always, you know, wanting better things. And, you know, especially, you know, because I was put in the environment when my mother moved uptown, you know, the people, you know, all my friends' parents were like, you know, you know, professionals. And my mother was a beautician. She was a blue collar worker. But when we moved uptown, all my friends' parents, you know, they were, you know, pretty much white collar. You know, they worked at Social Security. Some people were scientists, all kinds of stuff. So, you know, and I knew that would make my mother proud if I became something. So, you know, I think the question was connections. You know, everything is connected.
Yes. All right. Mr. Boston.
Yes, ma'am.
When you heard that I was interested in this project and receiving some of your stories, was there anything that came to your mind that you wanted to share in particular?
Well, you know, initially when you said it, you said Pennsylvania Avenue and you had the cutoff date at 68. You know, I knew there was very little to contribute because, you know, most of the people that were around Pennsylvania Avenue in its heyday had probably passed away. You know, because that would definitely be my mother's generation and my older sister. You know, she really wasn't, you know, well, no, that wasn't her thing. You know, the nightlife and stuff of that nature. You know, but Pennsylvania Avenue was like, the center of the black community. It was the strip. You know, it was the strip from North Avenue all the way down to Martin Luther King. You know that, because you're familiar with that area, right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. You know, now it's, you know, full of life, but you're correct. And around after the riots, you know, it was gone.
And as an observer, do you think there were any other impetus to the change in Baltimore apart from the riots? Do you think it started right at that time, or were there other things that were contributing?
Oh, it was definitely the drugs. The drugs started coming in because, you know, I'm a former heroin addict. You know, I shot dopes and cokes for 45 years. You know, even though I did all those things, being a heroin addict. Is that impressive?
Yeah.
I'm telling you, because, I mean, from the time I was 14 years old up until about 4 or 5 years ago, I've been clean for 5 years now.
Congratulations.
But the the drugs, and they started coming in heavily I started getting high in 71 when I was about 14. You know, that was, you know, people getting high in 69 and 70, but it was few people. Because when I was getting high, you know, at 14, it was, you know, it was a small niche of people that did it. We were like a little small cult. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't widestream like it is now. It was like less than 1% of the population. Mm-hmm. Now it's 10% of the population. So, yeah, because, you know, heroin was like a buck. Mm-hmm. Just when the year before I started getting high, it was $1 for a pill. And that's cheap, good God. But, you know, with the influx of the drugs, you know, from the Vietnam War, mm-hmm. you know, the guys coming home from Vietnam, mm-hmm. and then, you know, the counterculture of getting high with the reefer. But, you know, they had the heroin in the black community. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they just started flooding the community. Mm-hmm. You know, with heroin. But I left Baltimore in 1979. Mm-hmm. You know, and I was gone for 20 years. But in the 70s, you know, getting high, you know, and there was no crack cocaine, none of that stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a little cocaine around, but it wasn't like out in California mm-hmm. or nothing like that. It would like trickle into Baltimore and everything. But in those years, it was really expensive to, you know, get high. You know, sometimes we had to, you know, put our money together because you had to have $35 to get like a six pack, but the prices were exorbitant. When I came after being gone for 20 years, because I came back home in 1999, I was surprised how cheap and accessible on every corner. Five and six different types on every corner. You buy a dope and you get a coke for free. All these crazy marketing skills. Mm-hmm. You know? But yeah, so definitely it wasn't the riots, it was the drugs. Okay. It was the drugs. Because, you know, even though it got torn down, there was no way it could have been rebuilt because the emphasis was no longer on the entertainment and all that stuff. It became drugs. Mm-hmm. That's where the money was at. Mm-hmm. And the, you know, the degradation, you know, degrading of the community, tearing it down, not building. Or maintaining. There was no maintenance of no avenue. Next question. Okay.
So this one may take you back a little. Can you think of when you were a child, some of your favorite treats or some of your favorite dishes? And how do those things sit in your memory?
Well, mental, mm-hmm. you know, as a child, I could care less about something to eat. Mm-hmm. As a child, all I thought about was having fun.
Okay. What did you like to do to have fun then?
Favorite foods? Who wanted to eat? Shoot.
What did you do to have fun as a child?
What we're talking about, you know, preteen.
Yes.
Or, you know, the regular stuff, cowboys, Indians, mm-hmm. you know, riding bicycles. You know, I mean, you know, I'm talking about when I moved uptown, you know, because we lived in the suburban areas, nothing but woods around, you know, catching frogs, you know, the typical, I would say, somewhat of a Leave It to Beaver life.
Okay.
You know, because I wasn't in the city no longer. Mm-hmm. And all we did was, you know, play in the woods, you know, all the stuff that you see on TV from the 50s mm-hmm. and the 60s, what guys did. Never played with a girl in my life. Mm-hmm. I mean, in elementary school, boys did not play with girls. Mm-hmm. It was a hard, fast rule, because I look at it today. I see, you know, boys and girls playing around, and the girls always wanting to be with, you know, with the guys or some old crazy stuff. You know, when I was coming up, you know, girls did whatever girls did. Mm-hmm. And boys did whatever we did. We didn't even play hopscotch with girls. Mm-hmm. If the boys, if we wanted to play some hopscotch, we didn't play with no girls. Mm-hmm. Only time I ever played with a girl was at recess, when we used to play, and we didn't call it kickball. We called it punch. Mm-hmm. We didn't kick the ball. We used to hold the ball in our hands and hit it with our fists. Oh, wow. You know, I never played kickball until I was in my 20s or 30s, because mm-hmm. we played punch. And that's the only time we ever played, because, you know, we came out after lunchtime, you know, at lunchtime at recess, and one class played another class, and, you know, everybody participated. But, you know, and then the other thing, we all might have played with the girls, and when we played the game, the boys chased the girls, mm-hmm. you know, and that kind of stuff, but we never played with girls. Mm-hmm. And it's so prevalent today, I can't understand it. Why boys let girls play with them? You know? I don't understand it. Mm-hmm. You know, because girls do what girls do. And let us do what we do. Mm-hmm. You know? Each has its own business. Y'all learn girl stuff, we learn boy stuff. So, as you probably can tell, I'm somewhat of a chauvinist, mm-hmm. because that's the age that I grew up in. Mm-hmm. You know, I grew up in the age of, you know, being a man, you had your rights and privileges.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing. It's beautiful to have different perspectives. So, thank you for sharing.
You never heard that perspective before?
No, it's not that I never heard it. It's just I appreciate when somebody shares their truth. So I appreciate that.
Okay.
So, being that you moved to the outskirts or the suburbs, were there any established institutions that would have been in that area near Baltimore, or did you know from your youth in Baltimore that people really took advantage of? I know some people that I've talked to said that they like to do skating. And of course you mentioned the movie theaters. I didn't know if there was anything else that popped in your head that was like, okay, yeah, if you was in Baltimore, if you lived in Baltimore, this is what you did.
Yeah, I do remember skating. And, you know, we used to have to go down by the Pennsylvania Avenue to go roller skating, mm-hmm. you know, because there was these, you know, it was called the Coliseum, mm-hmm. and it was on Monroe Street. Me and my sister, you know, would go every Friday, you know, to go roller skating. And like I said, you know, back during those days, there were so many different movie theaters. Mm-hmm. Good gosh. You know, there was no multiplexes. I mean, you know, we're not even going to talk about the cost, but just the fact that, you know, in a given area, there might have been, you know, down in that Pennsylvania Avenue, there must have been at least 7 to 10 movies, mm-hmm. you know, just in that little small area right there. But, you know, when we moved out in the suburbs, that was 3 or 4 movies, you know, in the general vicinity that you could walk to. But so far as institutions, no, not really. I can't really think of any big institutions. No, we had the mall, Ma John Dahlman Mall, you know, where, you know, as a teenager, you know, you would go hang out down there for a while. You know, same thing they did in the 90s. Mm-hmm. So that wasn't nothing new. You know, going to the mall.
And by the time that you moved out to the suburbs, was that further away from the root of the Arabbers? Did they have that out there by the time that you moved out there?
No, there were no Arabbers out there.
Was that something that was basically strictly in the city of Baltimore?
Right, in the city. That was definitely in the city.
Did you ever experience did you ever experience your uncle Blue doing A-Rabbin?
Oh yes. You know, every summer I would go down to the stables. You know, that's where I learned to ride horses. And I would, you know, go on his, you know, route with him sometimes. And I particularly didn't like it. Mm-hmm. You know, it was too ghetto for me. I didn't particularly like it, you know, because I was never hands dirty and stuff, and you know, it wasn't real my speed, but I did it, you know, for a few summers because it was kind of a rite of passage for, you know, the males in the family that came after me, because I have two a nephew and a cousin, you know, that, you know, went down there. You know, I mean, I didn't know. I just heard, because, you know, I was older than them, and I'm sure the other males on my uncle's side, and they went down there too. But, you know, I learned how to ride horses and, you know, learned how to do the watermelon and all that kind of stuff. You know, the calls. But, yeah, it was nice, you know, to do something different. Mm-hmm. That's what I enjoyed about it, that it was just a different experience. Mm-hmm.
What part of the suburbs did you move to when you guys moved out of Baltimore?
I guess you could, it's Northwest Baltimore. Mm-hmm. It was called the Grove Park section. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with like Wabash Avenue, mm-hmm. Northern Parkway?
Yes.
Okay, that area that's not going towards Reisterstown Road, but where was that? That's Wabash. Okay. Yeah, down below Wabash, going towards Liberty Heights in that area, mm-hmm. because I remember when Northern Parkway and Wabash was being built. Mm-hmm. You know, we used to play up there when they started doing the construction. Mm-hmm. 'Cause they cut off, you know, our route, you know, because we used to like walk through the woods, mm-hmm. and that was a wooded area. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they kind of was destroying, you know, the woods. Mm-hmm. And, so up in that area.
And just a few more questions. What helped you decide that you would want to take on the profession of teaching when you finished with the Army and your schooling?
Well, several factors. One, I thought teaching was the easiest job that there could ever be done from being a student. And I was a student, or, you know, I never went to school after elementary school. I never went to school. I cut every Friday religiously. I may have went to school maybe 3 days out of the week. And then I would cut, come and sign. I don't know how y'all have it in D.C., but I would come in and sign in for homeroom. And I would leave. And in junior high school, I would come back at the last period, you know, because we always had hooking parties and stuff. And, you know, nobody listened to teachers or none of that stuff because they were boring. They weren't doing anything. So to answer your question, I figured it must have been the easiest job. And after coming from the military, after working, you know, getting up 5 o'clock in the morning, you know, you had 24-hour days, I figured it was the easiest job. And I got off at 3:30 and I had the summers off. I couldn't think of anything better to do. And as a teacher, I probably won in those 13 years, you know, favorite teacher, 13 years. I spent 5 years in Ohio teaching, and then 5 years on the Eastern Shore, and three in Prince George's County. And because, you know, for me, I would, you know, like to change because, well, one, because of my drug addiction, you know, because I was the type of person that could dress up and be a shirt and tie and all, but at nighttime and all that other stuff, I would mess with some of the dregs of society. I didn't understand it because I didn't know anything about addiction. I just thought I had a character problem. I couldn't figure out what was wrong with my character. I could always be around these type of people, you know, living this double life. But I was like, you know, change after about 5 years, because I would always be afraid of, like, and I kind of, you know, compared to like a homosexual, I was in the closet, you know, and I was always afraid of being outed as an addict. I would leave after 5 years. You know, when my, you know, addiction would start to really become bad, you know what I'm saying? You know, where, you know, my people might be able to see signs that, you know, this behavior is kind of peculiar. And I would just go to another school system because I've lived a very peripatetic life. You know, I've traveled, you know, all over the world and all over the United States. I've lived in so many states and, you know, all of that stuff. But, you know, back to, you know, the teaching thing, I just knew that, you know, I got off at 3:30, you know, and after working in the military for, you know, all them years of being a soldier 24/7, you know, teaching was the thing. Plus, I like being in charge. You know, that's what my daughter said. She said, you just like being in control. And I loved it because I had my class and I was in charge of my classes. And I never had disciplinary problems or none of that other stuff. You know, because I found teaching, why nobody, you know, really listens in school, because the teachers aren't talking about nothing. You know, I mean, you know, the school system is ridiculous because they're not teaching anything. Because my thing was peripheral learning, the things that you learned on the side, not the stuff that was in the book, but how you connect everything with life. Consequently, you know, kids like me. Plus, you know. I could relate to them because I was a kid at one time. Because mind that most teachers are the same people when you were in school who said they wanted to be a teacher. You know, those, you know them people? Yeah, and those are the people that become teachers. And those are the people, they're nerds, they don't know shit. And their aspiration was to be a teacher. They're a teacher. And most of them is the shit that they learn in some school, at college, and in some book. Teaching is much more than that.
Yes.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to teach.
Well, thank you for your service, and thank you for your service. I appreciate this. I guess that would lead me to my last question. What drove you to join the military after growing up in and out of the outskirts of Baltimore? And what drove you to decide to take a military job? And was there any connection to your lineage and the men who had already joined the military?
What got me to join the military is I was in college, going to Towson, and I was a biology major because I wanted to be, you know, working the sciences and all that other stuff, because I was under the wrong impression when I went to college. I thought you went to college to learn something. And you have to go with your natural resources. I didn't know that I didn't like working in labs and working with things. I enjoyed working with people. But I didn't take up those type of courses because that's what I knew instinctively. So I'm trying to learn this science, physics, and all this other kind of shit. And I found myself only getting 8 credits and 10 credits a semester. And I must have been in my junior year, but I only had enough credits as a sophomore. And I saw, oh, hold on for a minute. Gosh. Oh, shit. I had some tea on. I forgot.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was talking about what made me join the Army. Yeah, it was a thing that I didn't have enough credits, and I happened to see a commercial on TV about ROTC. Okay. They were giving up $100 a month, and you know, you got a commission afterwards. So I joined the ROTC program. Now, you got to remember, I'm shooting dope all this time. Mm-hmm. In college, shooting dope. So, you know, I did that not knowing anything, nothing about the Army, no connection, never heard anything about the Army in my life. But, you know, I took them up on it. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it helped me graduate because I changed my major from sciences and I changed it to psychology. And where I was getting D's and F's, you know, I started getting A's and B's in psychology and sociology and all them type of subjects. Mm-hmm. And I wound up, you know, graduating just a semester behind, but in time to get my commission.
Okay.
And I went off and, you know, got commissioned as a second lieutenant and traveled all over the world. Mm-hmm. My first assignment was in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. Shoot. Can you imagine being 21 years old in Hawaii?
I can only dream.
Good God. So, yeah, that's why, you know, I went into the military because I saw that commercial. Mm.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Mr. Boston, for taking the time out to share today and to give to this project, Beauty Beneath the Blight. Is there anything else that you wanted to speak on before I conclude this interview?
The drugs. Mm-hmm. Killed our community. Mm-hmm. Killed all the... Destroyed 3 generations. Mm-hmm. 3 generations. And all I can do is hope and pray that this generation that's here, these children that are like 10, 11, 12, mm-hmm. can overcome the damage that has become to their parents, their grandparents and maybe their great grandparents, because my generation is the one that fucked up the latter generations, mm-hmm. my children. You know, you follow what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because we, and so many of us in the black community, and I really can't say this, Bintu, because, you know, I don't know other than the drugs that I saw and the number of people, because I know there's a population of blacks that didn't get involved. Mm-hmm. However, as I look at our culture today, mm-hmm. and even the culture of educated blacks, mm-hmm. you know, because when I first talked to you, I saw that you were a different class. Mm-hmm. You follow what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And I immediately was impressed with you because, you know, I see so much on the TV. You know, there's no assimilation into the American culture. Mm-hmm. There's just a black culture. Mm-hmm. You follow what I'm saying?
Yes.
There's no American culture. You know, we have a black culture that I think, and you know, this is just my opinions, that it makes us outliers mm-hmm. in this Americana. You follow what I'm saying?
Yes.
Because we don't have no people that want to assimilate anymore. Mm-hmm. Or not many, you know, and that's these generations that are around now. Mm-hmm. Because prior we had, you know, and I guess it's my mother's generation, they wanted to assimilate into, you know, the American culture. Mm-hmm. And that's what motivated them to try to be better, because they would, you know, they wouldn't, they, not that they wanted to be like white people, but they wanted to have things, you know, they wanted to have things, and they want, you know, you follow what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know, and I don't see that now, and I'm in the twilight of my life. But I don't really see too much of that going on. Mm-hmm. Do you?
I think there's a lot, so much going on right now. It's hard to digest what is what. So.
Okay. You know, so when do you think you'll finish with your project?
So we're trying to wrap up with the interviews this week. Mm-hmm. And we'll start breaking down the information that we have and start doing okay. transcripts. But the project is scheduled to go up at the end of May and mm-hmm. to stay up through the end of June. And okay. right now we're trying to figure out whether or not, of course, with the COVID pandemic going on, whether we'll be able to have a physical exhibition or if we're going to do it online. So the results of everything should be present by the end of May.
Oh, wow, that soon?
Yeah.
Okay, wow. All right. Well, keep me informed, and I enjoy talking with you.
Thank you so much. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And I will be in contact with you to send you some paperwork about the project and whatnot. And,
okay,
I wanted to thank you again. I'm going to go ahead and close out on the recorder. This has been Tukuyate with Mr. Jay Boston.
And I want to thank you so much for allowing me to be a participant and a voice in your project.
Thank you. Thank you. And I hope that there'll be a time that you may consider giving us more input on your life in the future, as this project, we hope will be picked up by the next cohort and the next iteration.
Okay, certainly, certainly.
All right. So this is Ben Tukuyate and Jay Boston.
And be safe out there.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. This is Ben Tukuyate interviewing Jay Boston on Thursday, April 2nd, 2020, in the third floor of the home on Woodington Road, Baltimore, Maryland. This is for the Beauty Beneath the Blight project, a project of the Urban Arts Leadership under Greater Baltimore Cultural Alliance and in the direction of Kabibi Ajanku, under the direction of Kabibi Ajanku. This is a project that is being sponsored by the National Endowment for the Arts and being partnered in with the Library of Congress and with Smithsonian Folklife Center for History and Culture. This has been T signing off.